Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with increasingly desperate denunciations of the press by Donald Trump, who, having created a firewall at the DOJ with Sessions, the CIA with Pompeo, the DNI with Coates, the Senate Intel Committee with Burr, and the House Intel Committee with Nunes, appears to be constructing a cover-up against mounting evidence of his collusion with Putin by pushing the narrative of fake news, in the hope that when the truth comes out, enough Americans will not believe it so that Trump could be saved from impeachment. Malcolm Nance, a globally recognized counterterrorism expert who has been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and Sub-Saharan Africa, and is the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyberspies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election, joins us to discuss whether Trump has succeeded in putting a cork in the bottle, or if the truth will find a way of leaking out. Then we'll get a strategic overview of broader issues that might be at play in Putin's relationship with Exxon's Rex Tillerson, now the United States Secretary of State, and how energy deals and pipelines underway in Siberia and Russia's Pacific regions are aimed at realigning Russia's relations with China, Japan, and South Korea. Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University, specializing in societies in China, Japan, Korea, and Russia, joins us to discuss the politics of energy in that region and the significance of China's cutoff of coal imports from North Korea and the likely consequences from the North Korean leader's use of VX nerve gas to assassinate his older brother in Malaysia. Then finally, we'll assess whether the election of former Labor Secretary Tom Perez to head up the DNC with his rival Congressman Keith Ellison, appointed as his deputy, will unify the progressive and centrist wings of the Democratic Party as its leadership tries to play catch-up to the explosion of demonstrations, activism, and energy erupting at the grassroots against the Trump administration. Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project and served as Executive Director of the Democratic Campaign Committee and the Executive Director of the House Democratic Caucus, joins us. And joining us now is Malcolm Nance, a globally recognized counterterrorism expert and intelligence community member who has been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and Sub-Sahara Africa. He's the author of An End to Al-Qaeda, The Terrorists of Iraq, Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe. And his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyberspies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. Welcome to Background Briefing, Malcolm Nance.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. And what's your sense of that overall framework that I offered up there, that in effect Donald Trump has created a firewall with Sessions at the DOJ, Pompeo at the CIA, Coates, who apparently will eventually get at the DNI, and then he's got Burr at the Senate Intel and Nunes at the House Intel Committees, both of whom, by the way, have been shilling for Trump, trying to get the press to discount the New York Times stories about the Trump campaign's connections to Russian intelligence. Do you accept that idea that there is a firewall?
Well, I accept the idea that he's trying to establish a firewall. I don't think that he'll be able to successfully create an axis of like-minded people that will successfully be able to stop any information that would come out. And all it will do, if something is nefarious and there are things that are found out in these investigations, or it moves on to a Senate Select investigation, all it will do is test these people's individual loyalty to the United States or to Donald Trump. And like in all good cover-ups, if you go along with the program and you decide you're going to be part of the cover-up, you are committing a crime. And these are all very well-experienced lawyers and senators, and they understand that there's only so much they can do. You know, going out and making public pronouncements is one thing, but there are more people on the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees, and they have staffers, and the CIA has much more deeply involved staffers than just the director of the CIA and the deputy director. Technically, there's only four or five people they bring into the agency. So there's an enormous amount of interest out there. And, you know, I was asked recently about, well, what's the nature of these leaks? Why are people in the intelligence community and the government doing it? And when you have a person who you believe you can't report to, who might possibly be corrupt or might possibly be in collusion with the opposition, you go and take that information out to the ultimate commander-in-chief, and that's the American public itself.
But do you think Trump's increasingly desperate attempts to attack the press and to frame the press, particularly the press that's been looking into these ties, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, etc., excluding them from press conferences and attacking them constantly as fake news, and even more shrill form than he normally does, I detect a certain desperation. Certainly, it does appear to be the actions of a guilty person, or to be more kind, perhaps somebody that feels trapped. But is there a cynical component to this, in the sense that Trump might be preparing at least his followers, 40% or less of the American people, to believe that when if indeed the truth finally comes out about his connections to the Russians, that they will consider it to be fake news?
Yeah, I think that your contention right there, as you said in the introduction and so eloquently just explained, that is his plan. He is now gaming the system. He's conducting a perception management campaign. And what he wants is to start out and frame the narrative in his terms. You know, I said this quite forcefully yesterday on NBC News. We were having a discussion about this. And I said Donald Trump is only governing for 25% of the American people. And that's the 25%, the hardcore, that elected him into office, that would follow him to hell. And he does not care, does not govern for, and has no intention of providing any succor or sustainment to the other 75% of the United States. You know, there's 50% of the voting electorate didn't vote. 25.6% voted for Hillary Clinton, and he has no interest in them. And you can see that right now his attempt to game the news media is clearly a plan to allow him to do what he wants, but to give the perception that whatever he says is correct. And once those people believe it, he doesn't care what the rest of the nation believes. The question is, does American democracy continue to function? Will there be, representative, government listen to that other 75% if the opinion polls go to critical mass? And we've already seen that Donald Trump does not care about opinion polls. He believes that any opinion poll that comes out, it didn't predict his election, therefore it's all completely invalid, and those people don't exist in his mind. And this is where the real danger comes in. Who will enforce the law if the lawmakers side with Trump, and if the political machine sides with Trump, and the Constitution becomes just a piece of paper?
Now, Darrell Issa, was he on Bill Maher with you? You were on the other day as well, were you not?
Well, he was on the week after.
The week after you. You were on with the trolling provocateur, right?
That crazy kid.
Right. He's had his bit of a comeuppance, yeah. So, but ISIS remarks that he actually thought that there should be an independent inquiry have certainly got a lot of Republicans upset, and I'm not entirely sure why ISIS said that. But nevertheless, Tom Cotton on the Sunday morning talk shows pushed back against it, and said that we're getting ahead of ourselves. So clearly there's no enthusiasm for that idea. The Democrats are in the minority. What's it going to take to have a real investigation?
Well, what it's going to take is fear. And that's what Darrell Issa is feeling. He's feeling fear that there could be a backlash wave of super enthusiastic, liberals and centrists who will all come together and create that wave, who can harness that other 50%, as I like to call it, the 50% of people that did not vote at all in this election. And if there appears to be, politicians are political animals. Someone, I actually said this on Twitter the other day. They will vote when it comes down to an instinct of survival. But if they feel that they're comfortable and safe and Donald Trump is the person and he has that super crazy motivated 25%, then they'll go along with Trump. But once they start to fear that that's in danger, then they will abandon him quickly and suddenly become, you know, demanding bipartisanship and kumbaya and everything that they denied Barack Obama. So I think Carol Issa, being a California resident, you know, he has to understand that he's unleashed powerful forces. Donald Trump has unleashed powerful forces against him, not just against the party. He may not survive the next election.
So what do you know, Malcolm Nance, about what's in the pipeline in terms of intercepts? And I understand that some of the Baltic states provided intercepts. I understand that that there was finally, after I think two other attempts, a FISA warrant in October that may have even named Donald Trump. We don't know, obviously. And we know from the reporting, from, as I mentioned, from the New York Times and others, and apparently the Wall Street Journal has also got some pretty explosive information in the pipeline. What, is it true that there are within already, in terms of inside our intelligence community, an awful lot of evidence of communications between the Trump campaign and Russians? Let's just call them Russians. And indeed, some of it not only went on during the campaign, but even after the campaign. Is that your understanding?
Well, that's my understanding, just on the basis of public reports and, you know, non-attributable information that I'm hearing. I certainly don't discuss, because I worked in at NSA for a period of time. I don't discuss communications intelligence, right? But on the other hand, the information that we're seeing come from, you know, open sources, from the New York Times, from the Wall Street Journal. There's some very, very good collection. Listen to that. I'm using the wrong word. There's some very, very good reporting going on there. And that reporting is terrifying this White House. This is, you're not seeing just a denial of information. What you're seeing here is a massive pushback, to the point where they are willing to run very close to breaking the law by going to the director of the FBI, the deputy director of the FBI, and two senators on intelligence committees and saying, you need to characterize this as not nefarious, as nothing there. That's the first step of a cover-up, right? You want to engineer, the people whose voices out there hold the greatest volume. And so for the White House to have done that, that's just a sign that there is something there. That report, by the way, in CNN from 3 days ago, actually did something that I hadn't seen in the reporting before. It appeared, based on the White House's denials, to validate the report from the New York Times that there was an active investigation open. There are FISA warrants that have been issued. And in fact, if you go back through the information, that had never been verified. And they wouldn't do this pushback unless they existed. Correct. So, I think they may have shot themselves in the foot here. And anything they do at this point is just going to smack of conspiracy. And they really need to, there really needs to be a House and Senate Select Committee who have subpoena power with someone of a bipartisan ilk who can run this to ground. Maybe it's not those four individuals who have communications or connections to Russian intelligence, but the United States was attacked in a massive cyber warfare attack, which actually hacked the mindset of the American people. It hacked the psyche of the news media to the point where they would only report negative stories about Hillary Clinton. Never occurred before in the history of the 240 years of the United States that a foreign power placed a very heavy hand on the election and selected their candidate as president. That alone requires this to be investigated deeply.
Well, clear, but not by the Select Intelligence Committees, because that takes place in secret. It has to be an open forum, doesn't it?
Right. There would have to be a select subcommittee.
Sure. But clearly already there's an extraordinary coincidence and an analogy here with Watergate, given that Watergate was a burglary into the DNC. In this case, right, this was a Russian electronic burglary into the DNC and into Podesta. And I've always assumed that if you hack Podesta's email, the first customer for that, assuming that the Russians did it, the first customer for that would be the Trump campaign itself, because they were the ones that would most benefit from it. It seemed that giving it to WikiLeaks was like sloppy seconds.
Actually, I wrote in my book. My book was I wrote this book 7 months ago, and it got into bookstores 5 months ago. And the beautiful part about it is the President of the United States at the time, Director of National Intelligence, and the CIA have all validated my assessment, and conclusions came out exactly in line with the CIA's, issued at the same time as the CIA's. And that's because I'm not a journalist. I'm an intelligence officer, so I see things differently. This hacking was Watergate 2.0. That's actually the title of my first chapter. They carried out a successful Watergate. They got in, they got all the information, they wiretapped the DNC, so to speak. They extracted everything from chats to voicemails to credit cards, everything for 10 months. And all of that information was applied through WikiLeaks, which was their laundromat, and focused initially to break the link between Hillary Clinton followers and Bernie Sanders followers on the first day of the Democratic National Committee. And it was successful. I still hear people to this day, just yesterday, in the debate about the new director of the DNC, people saying Hillary Clinton stole the election from us. The WikiLeaks emails prove it. That was a massive political warfare operation carried out by the theft of everything at the DNC. The Russians have the capacity to go into the RNC, but they didn't because they are working for the RNC. They wanted Donald Trump elected. They used WikiLeaks and then put out things with Podesta's leaks. But I want to call attention to one thing. The one thing that wasn't released in this election was Hillary Clinton's actual emails from her servers. And that proves that her server wasn't ever hacked. But everyone around her was hacked. And that's how they got to her emails indirectly.
Well, we first learned about the server, though, her server, from a hack of Sid Blumenthal's that revealed who he's communicating with. And that was first put out by RT in back in 2013, I think it was, as a public service. Yeah, so that became a significant story. Obviously, that dogged her throughout the campaign. And that was first revealed by the Russians. But my question would be, if you're going to hack the DNC and you're going to hack Podesta, that intelligence would be most useful for the Trump campaign itself because they could be reading the enemy's mail. Do you think that happened? Do you think that happened?
You know, I wrote about this in my book. The first indicator that made me raise my eyebrows about the DNC hack was in early April, early to mid-April, Judge Napolitano of Fox News came on TV and said, made a very amazing statement based on a piece of news that came from a very remote Russian source saying that the Russians had all of the DNC's emails and that there was a debate going on in the Kremlin about releasing all of these emails and Hillary Clinton's emails. And of course, anyone who's in the intelligence community would know there's only two ways that you get that information. One, it's either not true, or two, if it is true, this man has access to the highest, most secret U.S. intelligence in the world, which we don't believe he does. Or two, your opposition, the Russians themselves, have leaked that information in order to set the pace for the people that they intend to support. And from that point on, I started wondering the same thing that you're pondering here. Does the Trump campaign have direct communications with these people? Because by mid-July, we had reports that Carter Page, the so-called advisor to Donald Trump, was in Moscow promising that a President Trump would raise sanctions. We had then Donald Trump himself come out on July 27th and say, Russia, if you're listening, please release the hacked Hillary Clinton emails. At that moment, he either became aware, was aware, and validated the belief that he knew Russia was working in his interest. And it doesn't matter. I mean, any other candidate in the world would deny any assistance from Russia. And this is a man who was asking for it. Where did the conversations occur where Donald Trump learned about the DNC hackings, that how they were occurring to his benefit? And at that point on that day, he believed Russia was the nation carrying them out in his interest. And all of a sudden, since that time, he doesn't know anything about Russia, he's never heard about Russia, and he doesn't know anything about any hackings, right? So, I mean, this requires investigation. I mean, we really need to get to the bottom of this. If any American citizen is complicit in this hacking, understood or coordinated this hacking, then they have carried out a crime. Now, it's not treason. There's no war going on here. It's not even the Espionage Act. But it is conspiracy to work with a hostile intelligence agency. And we can definitely take you to court on that.
Well, just in the last minute, Malcolm Nance, what do you think about then the, surely the role of FBI Director Comey becomes central here. He already is, has upset Hillary and the Democrats by what they consider his last minute intervention tipping the scales for Trump. But on the other hand, he's now being attacked by Trump himself. So is he the key to this, whether this we're going to have a real inquiry and this evidence is ever going to come out?
I think that the investigation with Hillary Clinton, which involved regular gumshoe FBI agents, he just saw it as a political decision and he made a bad political call. I know for a fact he would never, never compromise an FBI counterintelligence investigation. And for the listeners, counterintelligence is the phrase we use for spy hunting. So that's very significant, the people that are doing this. They work under the Director of National Intelligence, and they are the people who capture foreign spies and find Americans working with spies. So this is not just any investigation going on. This may be the single most serious investigation and quite possibly scandal in the history of the United States since secession.
Well, on that note, Malcolm Nance, I thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
And again, I'm speaking with Malcolm Nance, who's a globally recognized counterterrorism expert and intelligence community member who's been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. And his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyberspies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back getting a strategic overview of broader issues involved in between China and Russia and the Japan and South Korea in Russia's Pacific regions. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gilbert Rusman, who's a professor of sociology at Princeton University, specializing in societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia. He's the editor of the ASEAN Forum and is the author of International Relations and Asia's Northern Tier, Sino-Russian Relations, North Korea and Mongolia, and Japan-Russia Relations, Implications for the U.S.-Japan Alliance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gilbert Rusman.
I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, thank you, Gilbert. And I want to talk to you about the possible relationship there. We know there's a relationship between Vladimir Putin and Exxon's Rex Tillerson, who is now the United States Secretary of State. But I wanted to get into the energy deals and pipelines underway, et cetera, and what their implications might be in terms of geostrategy. But let's start with the most inflammatory situation, which is, again, North Korea, the sort of delinquent state that gets the world's attention by doing outrageous things. In this case, it's really pushing the envelope where it looks as though North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, assassinated or ordered the assassination of his older half-brother in the airport in Malaysia using VX nerve gas, but even a binary version of VX, which means that two inert chemicals that are essentially harmless or toxic but harmless are then combined at the last minute to create one of the most dangerous and deadly nerve gases that we know of, VX. And so the first young woman who thought she was participating in a reality TV show applied one of the chemicals, and the second one applied the second one, and together they created VX, and 20 minutes later, the brother of Kim Jong-un was dead. And, of course, the girl that applied the second batch, she got sick, but she managed to she was instructed to wash her hands. Had Kim's older brother washed his hands, he may have washed his face, he may have survived, but he didn't know what had happened. So that is pretty, if you look at it just in the broadest sense, you know, that is a use of a weapon of mass destruction as an act of terrorism in a friendly country. That's a pretty provocative thing, don't you think?
Absolutely, and they're going even further by putting the blame on Malaysia and threatening Malaysia.
Well, what can they do? I mean, that's just bluster, isn't it?
That's their typical bluster. That's right. They can't actually do anything specific to Malaysia, but that type of bluster keeps occurring over and over again.
So the Chinese have cut off coal imports from North Korea, which is their largest source of foreign currency, to keep the regime and particularly keep the elite in on board. Essentially, mm-hmm. That's how you bribe the kind of nomenklatura with a higher standard of living while the rest of your population starves. But there's clearly the fact that he keeps killing members of the elite would indicate that he's worried about their loyalty. So if you cut the money off, which is essentially, I know they're being they're brainwashed from childhood into this kind of emperor worshipping mentality. But on the other hand, what's your understanding about dissent within the elite?
It's very hard to know about dissent in the North Korean elite. The slightest sign of dissent is punished in horrendous ways. They have received more material benefits. The Chinese have, until this year, continued to assist with expanded trade. There's a more of a market economy in North Korea, so there's been a construction boom in Pyongyang, the capital. So materially, I don't think we're at a point where that we can think the dissent among the elite is wide-ranging.
So what do you think then? Is China changing its tune? Because we keep pressuring China, and President Trump himself says China is the key, but China doesn't do anything. I think China actually gets benefit out of North Korea being such a wild card because it puts the U.S. and its Pacific Fleet in danger. It keeps the South Koreans on their toes and nervous, and it also does the same to the Japanese. So at what point does China figure the cost-benefit is not worth it?
I think we shouldn't think of this as a dichotomy where, on the one hand, China, if it finally makes that decision, will sort of side with South Korea and the United States and put enormous pressure on North Korea and try to get some kind of regime change that's favorable to reunification on South Korean terms. That's not the alternative to what it's been doing, rather shielding North Korea by making sure the sanctions aren't very tough while trying to put some pressure on North Korea all along. I think China has an overall strategy to try to use North Korea, as you suggest, to put military pressure on the United States, to help create, to put pressure on South Korea, which has been effective at times, to bolster, China's plans to establish a more Sino-centric region, around it. So it moves sometimes towards more pressure, and that's what it's doing now. It's obviously more unhappy about North Korea, and it's willing to exert more pressure. This Kim Jong-un is a leader that Xi Jinping has not met with, not a single time. There have been strained relations at the top. This assassination is not the first instance where China has been angered. There was the murder of the number two figure in North Korea, Jang Song-taek, just a few years ago, who was known to be a kind of emissary to China, someone who was trying to help with economic ties between China and North Korea, and then he was brutally murdered. So China is unhappy, but that doesn't mean they're going to do some of the things that the U.S. would really welcome.
Let's talk about what might be going on in terms of a big strategic play, if indeed it can get started between Putin and Rex Tillerson, now the Secretary of State, formerly with Exxon. He made a deal with Putin over Arctic, extracting Arctic oil and also Siberian oil. There's a certain sort of cynicism to the Arctic oil because of global warming, it's now more accessible. But on the other hand, if you get it out of the ground and burn it, it adds to global warming. But that doesn't seem to be a concern of either Putin's or Tillerson's. But what if they can make the deal and go ahead, and I think the price to do so would be some kind of settlement in Ukraine, which the Trump, some of his people were trying to float a peace plan, which seemed pretty amateurish. But at the end of the day, let's assume that they can go ahead. What does Putin want? And my understanding is that in the broader sense, that if Putin could set up a relationship that Gazprom has now with Western Europe, where it supplies where Western Europe is dependent upon Russian gas, and therefore Western European governments are reluctant to criticize Russia, they have some leverage. If he can get the Chinese, the Japanese, and the South Koreans hooked on Russian energy, would he have the same leverage?
I don't think he would get a lot of leverage. The Western European countries, too, have been trying to reduce Putin's leverage by diversifying their supplies. There's much more liquid natural gas available now from international markets. So I don't think energy is going to give Russia the leverage it was anticipating just 5 or 10 years ago. However, he does want an economically powerful Russia to go with his other notions of how Russia can reemerge as one of the three most significant players on the world scene, along with the United States and China, and creating a kind of Russell-centric region, which is in different locations. But as far as the Russian Far East and the Arctic North, Putin is hoping for a massive trade route, which will make it, because of the warming, make it much easier to move goods between East Asia and Europe in a faster time and with shorter distances going through the Arctic. And he's seeking to again boost Russia's economy on fossil fuels, with large-scale exports heading to East Asian countries, especially China. China is by far the most important, and they're the biggest investor and partner in developing the Arctic so far, with especially the Yamal natural gas project. More pipelines he wants. He wants to make a big deal with Japan for this, and that the negotiations that led to the summit between Prime Minister Abe and Putin in Japan in December had a major economic component, and he's waiting for Japan to up its economic offer, and he'd be delighted if the United States would join in and become part of a broader economic consortium, assisting Russia with these economic plans. And in fact, when Abe and Trump met in Florida just 2 weeks ago, one of their topics was cooperation in dealing with Russia. Both are interested in working more closely with Putin. So this is part of an effort to strengthen Russia and to help it turn to the east, where it becomes a major figure in Asia, as it has been in Europe.
But my understanding is that what the stark reality of Russia's Far East is, it's very, very thinly populated. And you've got all this enormous territory with all of these resources, not just oil and gas, but also timber. And it's basically pretty pristine. But then you've got China with a billion people plus, with depleted landscape or water, the air is unbreathable in Beijing a lot of the time. So it seems to me that is there a concern on the Russian part of how do you maintain a stable border with this vast expanding population and countries thirsty for resources, and you're out there right across the border from them, and there's virtually no Russians in the Pacific East.
Well, Russians have been worried since certain governors, demagogues, as early as 1993, began warning that China has a plan for quiet expansionism, reviving thoughts about the border dispute that helped lead to the Sino-Soviet split that took place for about 25 years. So yes, there's been talk in Russia and worry about that. But China and Russia have managed that pretty well. They had two agreements where they said they settled their border dispute. There's no more dispute. The Chinese who moved to Russia as traders or sometimes short-term farmers have been very few. Now the wages in Russia are pretty low because of the economic troubles in Russia and the fall of the ruble. And Chinese have left Russia feeling, hey, there's not much money to make here. And the main source now is the tourists who are coming into Russia for casinos and other goals. And that's not really going to damage their relationship very much. So I don't think there's that problem so much. But there is a sense that Russia wants more diversified economic ties in Asia, and so they've urged South Korea to help, but they've really not given very good incentives, and they've sided more with North Korea than South Korea in terms of how to deal with the nuclear issues, so the South Koreans have pulled away from that. They've tried to get Japan to help, but Japan has been interested in islands and not really thinking that it's going to have a big economic benefit from working more closely with Russia. And their talks have slowed. It's not clear if there's going to be much progress in the next year or two. So with the U.S., it's not clear that the U.S. would gain from these energy ties. Maybe a few companies would profit, as Exxon and might, but the prices are pretty low for gas and oil right now. And so some of these investments, particularly in the very expensive environment of Siberia and the Arctic, don't look like they'll pay off right now. So I wouldn't think that the U.S. sees much advantage in that kind of an agreement with Russia. Maybe that would help whet Russia's appetite for doing something that the U.S. wants. But right now, I don't think Putin is willing to have that kind of a trade-off.
Well, Gilbert Rosman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're entirely welcome.
And again, I'll be speaking with Gilbert Rosman, who's a professor of sociology at Princeton University, and his latest book is Japan-Russia Relations, Implications for the U.S.-Japan Alliance. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the election of the former Labor Secretary Tom Perez to head up the DNC with his rival Congressman Keith Ellison appointed as his deputy will unify the Democratic Party. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national level. Matt Hagel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he's executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Hagel.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Matt. And finally, the Democratic Party at least has a leader in terms of a chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Various news outlets keep referring to it as being a kind of leaderless party, somewhat in the doldrums. What do you think of the election of former Labor Secretary Tom Perez and in defeating Representative Keith Ellison, who he has made as his deputy?
Well, it was a long and it was a painful process, but I think it was an important process in that all the candidates got a chance to make their case to Democrats over the entire country. There was a lot of serious consideration given. There was a lot of coalition building going on, and I think that really showed up in the end when Tom Perez won but immediately embraced Keith Ellison and brought him on as his deputy, and Keith Ellison in turn embraced that opportunity and joined with Tom Perez. I think it really shows that Democrats are making progress. There's a long way to go because the party is in tough shape and it's got a lot of work in order to rebuild.
So in terms of the mechanics of the votes, on the first ballot, Perez was one vote short of the 218, with Ellison trailing by about 200 votes. And then in the second round of voting, Tom Perez beat Keith Ellison by 18 votes, or he had 18 votes more than he needed. So it was pretty close. And the first thing that the former Labor Secretary did was nominate his rival, Keith Ellison, as the number two. So do you think the healing, as they keep referring to, is it done? Is it? But Ellison called on the Democrats. They didn't. Basically saying you don't have the luxury of division anymore. So let's unite. So beyond the rhetoric, is that a reality? Do you think?
It certainly is a reality from the standpoint of there's an understanding that we have to get along, that we don't have the luxury of arguing over minor matters. And among Democrats, we like to debate and we like to get emotional over differences. And you can do that when you're in the majority or when you hold offices. But when you're in the minority, you've got to look for the things that unite you and build from those. And I think it's really important that Keith Ellison understands that and moved quickly to unite with Tom Perez.
So given that that already there's been one race in the Trump era in Delaware that went the Democrats' way, and there's a couple of others, how do you bridge the gap between, or the apparent gap, between the activism that's out there, that's manifest? The day after Trump's inauguration, millions of women and others showed up around the world and across the country, particularly in Washington, D.C., in crowds that were greater than Trump's inauguration crowd on the day before, in spite of what Trump keeps saying. So my sense is that you have, in many ways, you have activism in search of strategy. Are the Democrats going to provide that strategy?
We have to. If we don't, then we will have squandered what is a legitimate grassroots organic activism. I've never seen it in my political life, and I've been doing this 25 years. So many people spontaneously engage in the political process and organize themselves. And we have a really important job to provide some strategic support without pretending to take over. I think it's very important that you allow this new leadership to present itself and to be in a position of leadership, but at the same time provide resources and provide direction so that you turn activism into campaigns, because it's very important for Democrats to win some races. We win a lot of arguments, but we don't win enough elections, and we've got to start winning elections in addition to winning arguments.
But one of the reasons why the Democrats haven't been winning of late is because, well, I think one is Citizens United, which opened the floodgates of money, which largely went to the Republicans. And in many ways, their strategist, Karl Rove, hit the ground running in 2010 or prior to that with lots of money, and was able to get a midterm strategy at the very that coincided with the census, and arguably that is the groundwork was laid for all the gerrymandering that took place. That's been an enormous advantage to the Republicans. Now, my understanding is that in 2020, the Democrats have an opportunity to try and level the playing field a little bit in that regard, but that's fast approaching, and so is 2018, the midterms. So what's your sense of whether or not there is a real strategy out there? I recall Barack Obama used to say the Democrats are almost a genetic problem with the Democrats that they don't show up for midterms. Given the kind of manifestations we've seen of spontaneous demonstrations, do you think that in 2018 the Democrats are going to show up in the midterm?
I think we've got an opportunity to create the type of urgency that will get voters to turn out. And I also think that Donald Trump has presented a threat, not just a threat to Democrats, but a threat to people's sense of what our country is about and to American values. And really, I've seen now people show up at rallies, and I've talked to them and I've been to rallies where people have shown up who have defaulted to Republicans in off-year elections, because that's typically who's been winning, and that's what they've seen kind of where things are going. They now understand that partisanship is not just Democrat versus Republican. Now you've got to decide whether or not one party or the other is going to protect American values. And I think the Republican Party now belongs to Donald Trump. And I think every Republican out there who doesn't actively distance themselves from Trump runs a risk of being turned out in the off year in 2018.
So in terms, though, of this last election, particularly obviously losing the presidential election was a massive blow, given that the House and Senate also went down to Republican control, in fact, increased Republican control on both counts. So the Democrats at least have been able to hold on to the executive branch until Hillary Clinton's loss. One of the lessons that has been learned appears to have been the main lesson, seems to have been mislearned, at least. There was a piece in the New York Times recently by Democratic strategist Steve Phillips, along the lines of the Democrats are learning the wrong lessons. They keep saying that Hillary Clinton should have gone after the white working class vote in those three key states that she lost, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Phillips argues that no, what the real issue was that there was 9 million more Democrats voted for Obama in 2008 and 7 million more voted for Obama in 2007. And what happened to those voters is where the focus should be. And many of them went to Jill Stein and the Libertarians, or they just didn't show up. And in fact, a sufficient number of African Americans didn't show up in Pennsylvania that would have made the difference there. So do you think the lessons have been mislearned from Hillary Clinton's defeat?
Actually, I don't think any type of lesson has been learned yet. I think that's a big problem. I think that people are looking simplistically at saying, well, did we talk to enough white voters, or were we not passionate enough to talk to enough African American or Hispanic voters in order to rebuild the Obama coalition? And I think that it's time for Democrats to really understand that our party is a coalition party, and that we have to build a coalition of African American, Hispanic, and fair-minded Anglos that are mostly progressive in thought, particularly as it relates to economic issues. So the social issues are important as well, and that we start using the type of information that has worked in campaigns, and that is peers talking to peers. One of the major problems that I think that the Clinton campaign had that has been rarely talked about is the analytics that they used narrowed and narrowed and narrowed the number of people they were actually talking to so that they weren't actually communicating with enough people at any level, with African-American, Hispanic, or Anglo voters, and most importantly, with people who really hold economic concerns and economic insecurities as their major concerns. And I believe that Democrats have to move beyond this micro-targeting that has become micro-thinking and talk more broadly with people and actually use trusted messengers rather than just counting on analytics.
But my understanding is that it was the Trump people and Stephen Bannon and their big donor, Robert Mercer, who is the big part owner of Cambridge Analytica, along with Bannon, who's on the board, and that they first used the Cambridge Analytica's data mining of social media to win the Brexit vote, and they used the same tactic here in the United States. And, of course, the first thing they did was intimidated Zuckerberg at Facebook into suggesting this canard that he was favoring liberal news, and therefore they got Zuckerberg rolled over, got rid of the human curation of the news, because the Trump people and Bannon understood that something like three-quarters or two-thirds of Americans get their news from Facebook. So Zuckerberg rolls over, gets rid of the human curation of the news. They bring in algorithms, and the Bannon and Mercer people game these algorithms, micro-targeting different communities with different messages, whereas Hillary Clinton ran a 20th century campaign by blasting the same message out over the TV and spending an awful lot of money, and that's why the Trump people spent less money but were more effective. Do you buy that scenario?
Well, to a certain extent, what they were able to do is to mobilize a small base, a small and intensive base. I don't think the analytics were as important as they were willing to move an extreme message to a few people. And then they were able to mobilize them in the specific places where they needed them. And I think that what happened was that the Clinton campaign left themselves open to that because they made assumptions in certain states, and the obvious ones were Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, that people who had been voting Democrat would continue to vote Democrat. So I don't think it was a matter of them blasting the same message more broadly. It was a matter of not understanding where their vote needed to come from, and that the Trump campaign knew that they had a narrow path and they had a twisted path, and they stayed on that very deliberately. I don't think it was genius analytics as much as it was discipline and being willing to deliver a very harsh message and play to people's fears and insecurities, and they're continuing to try to do that. It's clear that his strategy to be influential going forward and perhaps to run again in 2020 is to keep this intense negative viewpoint active among a relatively small group of Americans and then to mobilize them.
But why didn't the Hillary campaign deploy Bernie Sanders more in those very states, particularly Wisconsin, where he won 90% of the precincts in the primaries, and Michigan, which he won in the primaries? What was their first clue, for God's sake? I mean, he was clearly, short of putting him on the ticket, because I don't know that the vice president did much good for them, but certainly deploying him in those states, was there a problem there? Did they not, were the rivalry with Bernie Sanders somehow blind them to his value as a surrogate?
I don't think it had much to do with them being concerned about or angry with Bernie Sanders. I think it was just the arrogance of believing that they had those states wired. and not realizing and taking into account that those are all states that have voted Republican in off-year elections and that Bernie Sanders had done well or won in those states, and that they needed to find a way to talk to those disaffected voters, whether it was with Bernie Sanders or with somebody else. It's not, they didn't just not send Bernie Sanders. They didn't send Hillary Clinton. And they only sent Biden and others at the very end. And so I think it was just a strategic mistake thinking that they had the opportunity to go reach into states where they probably never had a chance, like Arizona and early on Georgia and North Carolina, when they should have been paying attention to holding their base. Again, I don't think it was a matter of not being okay with Bernie Sanders or being upset with him. I think it was a more arrogance of their strategy and not really understanding that those states weren't reliably Democratic.
Well, just turning to your state, Matt Engel, Texas, my understanding is that the South and the West are the really the fertile areas for Democrats in the future, and that the Rust Belt, the lessons from the Rust Belt, again, may not be learned or sufficiently learned, and too much focus is on the idea of somehow winning back the angry white working class vote instead of recognizing that in states like Texas, they came awfully close in a lot of districts, and with a little more focus and a little more energy, Texas could eventually be turned blue, as also would be the case with our other states like Arizona. We obviously, California is solidly blue, but just in general, do you think that the Democrats should turn their attention to the South and the West and not be so focused on the winning back the Rust Belt?
Well, I think they need to expand their attention. I would not turn away from those Midwestern states, and I would not assume that those so-called angry white voters are lost forever, because they have economic concerns that are not going to be met by Trump administration. Ultimately, at the end of the day, Trump is going to side with the Goldman Sachs part of the world, and not with the working class of those Midwestern states. Now, that said, there's enormous opportunity in the West and in the Southwest. In my home state of Texas, Hillary did better than any presidential campaign has done in a very long time. And keep in mind that there was no presidential campaign in Texas. Hillary didn't spend any money in Texas, and really Trump didn't either. And so you really got a sense of what happens in a vacuum when just the people in the state are doing the work, and where you did have active campaigns in key counties, then Democrats did very well. For example, in Harris County, which is where Houston is, that's the biggest county in Texas. If it were a state, it would be bigger than 25 states by population. Democrats won every single contested race in that county for the first time since 1964, when LBJ was on the ballot. And so there are real opportunities in the South and the Southwest. It's a perfect example of where you have to build a coalition of African-American, Hispanic, and fair-minded Anglo voters. If you just concentrate on one of those three legs, then the stool will fall over. You've got to concentrate on all three of them.
Well, Matt Engel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.